If you've been told to pull up your socks, then make sure it's a pair of TNT socks. The TNT shop is now open at tntradio.live. From economics to the woke agenda, this is Unleashed with Mark Morano on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Do not adjust your set. This is indeed Unleashed with Mark Morano, but today it's Lambert Topic standing in for Mark just for a few days. The quality is just the same, even if the face is different, and the subject matter is very similar too. So glad that you're able to make it for this couple of hours when we have some fantastic guests talking about the matters which really affect us all now. The Middle East may seem a distant place, depending where you live, of course, but it's right up front and personal at the moment. We'll be talking about that with two real experts. We'll be speaking to individuals who know more than most about this. We have Dr. Waleed Faris, who is well-connected in the world of Middle Eastern politics and also a published author as well as an advisor. And after that, we won't just be walking away from the subject, we'll be continuing as well with a second guest who's got great interest in the subject too. So both of them will be joining me in this two-hour period. But before we speak to the good doctor, let me share something from the United Kingdom. And incidentally, wherever you are in the world, you're welcome to comment. Put your comments into tntradio.live. The chat is always active there. When I get a chance, I'll read out some of your messages, whether they're positive, negative, inquiring or critical. That's the nature of free speech, which is what today's News Talk TNT is all about. You can also find the phone numbers there if you want to. If you're enraged or inspired by what you hear, I'd love to hear from you. And as long as we've got time, we'll patch you into the conversation. Let me start, though, with something which is really bugging me today here in the United Kingdom. When I was a British Member of Parliament, a position I served for 13 years, I was always motivated by the libertarian agenda. In other words, trying to give you as much freedom as you can possibly have without actively harming other people. That was really why I got into politics and why I stuck it for so long. Sadly, it seems there was something very seriously wrong with the interpretation of freedom and liberty in the United Kingdom. Even as I speak to you here on today's News Talk TNT this evening, the parliamentarians in the House of Commons in Westminster, a mere 35 kilometres from where I'm sitting, are debating on whether to make it illegal, you heard me right, illegal for anyone who is 15 in the year 2024 to ever be allowed to buy tobacco in their lives. Let me say that again in case you think you've misheard me, and I'll put it in a different way. If you're 15 years old and you happen to be in the United Kingdom, if this legislation is passed, once it's gone through all its stages, it means it would be an offence for you to be sold tobacco, whether it's rolling tobacco, whether it's a cigar, whether it's a packet of cigarettes, whatever your age. So in 10 years' time, when you're 25, it's still illegal for the shopkeeper to sell you those cigarettes. When you're 50, 35 years from now, it's still a crime. And when you get to the venerable age of 70, if you're fortunate enough to get that far in 55 years' time, then it will still be a crime for the shopkeeper to sell you that packet of cigarettes. Why? Because of what the former Prime Minister, Liz Truss, who only lasted a matter of weeks, has described the health police. What she says in opposing this piece of legislation is that we are now beginning to curtail people's civil liberties for their own good. She says that she's going to oppose this legislation, as have some other libertarian members of parliament, people like me. But unfortunately, and yet again, we find ourselves in the invidious situation where both the Conservatives, they are the ruling party at the moment in the United Kingdom, but probably for not much longer, and the Labour Party, led by Keir Starmer, who is in all probability going to be the next Prime Minister in the UK, when both of those parties agree with each other, the leadership, namely Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, the Conservative, and Leader of the Opposition, Keir Starmer, the Labour man, both say it's a good idea to impose this ban for all eternity on any 15-year-old or younger who happens to have the misfortune to be born in the ever less libertarian United Kingdom. Now, just think about the implications of this. That means in 55 years' time, that is the year 2079, as you walk in with your walking stick at the age of 70 to try to buy that packet of cigarettes you've been yearning for 55 years, the shopkeeper has to ask for your identification. And if you haven't got your identification at the age of 70, and you can't prove that you are 71, for example, you don't get to buy the packet of cigarettes. I'm not a smoker. I never have been. And I'm unlikely to start now. That's not my concern. It's not some act of self-interest in me highlighting this to you and thus to the world. My concern is the precedent. What this is telling us is that the government and the opposition, the other party, the only party likely to replace the current government, are both in lockstep in saying we've reached a stage where we can future crime your actions on the basis of your age, all for the sake of your health. I heard one of the government defendants of this crass scheme say that this will save 500,000 lives between now and the year 2100. That means in the next 76 years. Well, first of all, I'm not completely convinced by that. But secondly, the precedent it's setting is that if something is bad for you in the future, we can ban your right to buy it from now on. Now, why have they chosen 15? I suppose they assume that existing smokers might just carry on ignoring the law and smoking. But at the same time, I've heard these self-satisfied authoritarians bleating on the mainstream media and the state-sponsored channel in the United Kingdom, telling us that this is a great idea, that actually a lot of people, doesn't sound like a statistical sample to me, but a lot of people who smoke would be pleased if their offspring and their grandchildren don't get the opportunity to do the same thing. Right then, where do we stop? Smoking, I imagine, isn't good for your health, but nor is eating a lot of fatty food. And as far as I'm concerned, that kills people too. Obesity, overeating is definitely bad for you. Cycling is a dangerous sport, and many people die in the process of cycling, pedaling for recreation or to and from work. Cave diving, whoa, don't get me started on that. While it may be invigorating, it's tremendously dangerous. I broke my back when I was paragliding in 1998. I nearly died. So where do you draw the line? At what point does the state have the right to interfere in your decisions? And what other countries will follow suit? Another shameful aspect of this legislation is the fact that the mainstream media and the state-sponsored station in the UK seem to be crowing about it. And the politicians are bragging about the fact that the UK will lead the world in stopping smoking through this intervention. For me, it's a matter of shame that a country that has gone to war at least twice in the name of liberty and lost many in the cause of the defense of freedom is now willing to use legislative processes to take away a pastime, which I think most people who smoke know isn't particularly good for them. I think it's a matter of a great concern that through this action, the government and the opposition, the uni party, as we often describe them here on today's News Talk, TNT, are agreeing they have the right to reach into your life and prevent you through the force of law to do things that you already know may not be in your best interest. There's an irony here. I would say one of the things which is worse for health, which kills more people than cigarettes and alcohol is British and American foreign policy. Will they ban that too? And what about the dietary restrictions? Are they going to now use the fact that many of us use credit cards to buy things to monitor what you purchase and veto the extra steak or the bag of chips or the third pizza in a week? And what will they do about the state-sponsored offence, which has caused, in my judgment at least, and it's my opinion, the greatest damage in recent years in the history of the governments of the world? The enforced vaccination, de facto, of billions of people. Now, I have to declare an interest on this one. I have suffered a vaccine injury and I struggled with various issues as a result. They're under control now, but I've had to enter a fitness regime, which I suppose makes me feel better than I did before. But others have died as a result of vaccine injury. Where is the consistency in governments like the British one forcing us to put something which has clearly turned out to be a toxin in the bodies of many, at the same time as forcing us not to do something they don't like, which is smoking? I put it to you from my many years in British politics that there is no consistency, that what we're now seeing is the same kind of madness that forced upon us the helmet law in the United Kingdom, which meant it was mandatory for motorcyclists to wear a helmet for their own good. Clearly, if you have an accident without a helmet, there's a risk of a head injury, but you're unlikely to harm anybody else. So the seeds were sown back in 1973. In that same year, they introduced the Misuse of Drugs Act, an act which was designed to stamp out heroin use in this country. At that time, there were 2,200 or so registered heroin users. Now, the number has increased manyfold. And the after-sales market motivates dealers to keep that market going. In the world of unintended consequences, the prohibition of heroin, instead of its prescription, created a market which has thrived in the intervening five decades. I make three predictions about this appalling intervention in the rights of the British, not just citizen, but visitor and resident. If we ban the right to buy cigarettes for anybody from the age of 15 up, number one, there will be a thriving contraband market to feed the interests of and the desires, not of those 15-year-olds, but of the 35-year-olds who are 15 in 2024 and everybody else. So instead of preventing smoking, it'll drive it underground with all the profit that goes with it. The second prediction I make is that it won't end here. That if they get away with this, the Conservative government of today and the Labour government of next year will proceed in trying to virtue signal their way towards saving us from ourselves. And in so doing, the Orwellian reality, where Big Brother knows best, will characterize the country that once celebrated its commitment to freedom and liberty. And the third thing I will predict is this. Those who smoke now will find an alternative. This won't save lives, and it certainly won't save money, because at some point in your life, you become expensive to the British National Health Service in those last days. It is only a council of fools that believes that there will be any cost savings through this. And it's a council of authoritarians who believe that we have the right to take away the freedoms of individuals for whom there may be precious few pleasures left in just about managing Britain. Now, I wonder what you think about this, and will this plague spread to America? America has tended to defend some freedoms better than others, but I worry what happens in this country often does get exported across the what's left of the Commonwealth of the United Kingdom. Over 70 countries in danger of that. And I worry that America might start competing too. My advice to parliamentarians, should they be willing to listen to an unreconstructed libertarian with 13 years experience as a British MP, is this. Vote no. Reject this intervention in the private lives of private citizens. Draw a line here. For if you don't, then sooner or later, you yourself will be affected as the state tells you what not to do. But hold on. Maybe that's not how it works. Maybe these rules will apply to all those who can't afford to travel, who can't afford to do things behind closed doors or buy hundreds of cigarettes abroad and give them to their 30-year-old son who's begged their father to do it. My friends, I do believe that now we're beginning to see the true colors of the unreconstructed orthodoxy, the orthodoxy that has brought you so much more bad besides this. We will see tonight what individual politicians do, because the vote will be shared in public. And the heroes will be those who vote against this pernicious piece of legislation. And the enemies of the state will be the ones who give the state the power to stop smokers. I wonder what you think. Do go to tntradio.live. Give me your views on chat. Maybe you disagree. Maybe you're a politician who thinks that you have got the right to do this. Let's have that debate. I promise you, I'll have you on my show either during this week or at the weekend, and we can have that dialogue. And more than anything, tell me if you care about freedom. I do, and that's why I work here at Today's News Talk. My next guest is another person who cares about freedom, and I'm pretty sure that you'll find Dr. Waleed Faris fascinating as he talks about his unique insights into the situation with Iran and makes his proposals about how we should resolve that. All of that here on the Mark Marano Show, where I'm standing in just for a few days on Today's News Talk. See you in a minute.
TNT's Joseph Arthur.
There was already lines being drawn in the sand because there was people resisting every step of the way. I was one of them. I was resisting the mask, and I was like questioning that openly on social media, and old friends were going like, you know, calling me an idiot and all this other stuff.
The data coming out of Israel showing that there was basically no efficacy with this vaccine, with the Delta variant. And so we knew what was coming. And at that point, we thought that the health agencies were actually going to try to be honest with the public and say, okay, the vaccines actually didn't work. We've got this new variant, you know, and try to maneuver out of it, which would then open up the door a little bit for the mainstream to go, oh, there's people being harmed. We've got some problems here. Okay, let's start talking about this. But instead, what they did is they doubled down, tripled down, quadrupled down on their narrative, as you saw, and they fueled this all-out war against the people like yourself who were awake. They saw the BS coming from a mile away, and they were just asking questions.
Joseph Arthur and his Technicolor Dreamcast on Today's News Talk, TNT.
The Lights is Britain's far-right conspiracy theory paper spreading hate and vicious lies. No, that's what the BBC say. The Light is the only national newspaper bringing you the real news and informed opinion on what's really going on today. You can subscribe, order copies, submit articles, and read back issues on our website, thelightpaper.co.uk, and see for yourself why the establishment are so worried about the uncensored truth getting out to people every month. The Light Paper. Not far right, just right so far. thelightpaper.co.uk.
Our next steps to space.
This time we go back to the moon to learn to live, to work, to invent, to create.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Mark Marano Show, where I'm Lambert Topping. I'm standing in just for a few days. Different face, but the quality and the subject matter remains the same. Joining me now, I'm very honored to introduce Dr. Waleed Faris, who's a true expert about Middle Eastern affairs. He's actually authored 15 books, including Iran, an Imperialist Republic, and U.S. Policy. And also, he has been an advisor to various presidential individuals, those involved with Donald Trump, for example, between 2015 and 2016. Dr. Faris, I do feel I'm in the presence of American greatness, and thanks for joining me.
Oh, thank you so much, Lambert. It's a pleasure, honor to be on your show.
It's absolutely likewise, not least because I've written 15 books, but I've only had 3 published so far. So you're 12 books ahead of me at the moment. But hope springs eternal.
You'll catch up.
I'm too busy on today's news talk these days to do that. Before we go into the subject, you have had an illustrious relationship with Capitol Hill. Tell me, what was it like working essentially for an American president or two?
Well, actually, there were 4 American presidential candidates I worked for. Donald Trump is the one who won. So, of course, I had better knowledge of his international political thinking because he appointed me in March of 2016 as his first foreign policy advisor. Of course, we were joined by 5 others. And then during the campaign, it became a whole institution before becoming the actual administration. I met with Donald Trump in December of 2015 after exchanges. And from my first meeting with him, I realized that though he's coming from private sector, and usually most of the other candidates have gone through sort of, you know, some public positions so that they could understand the government, he had a very good insight as to how international politics works because he was an international businessman and he had met many people. He did not meet them as a president, so he had already the experience. And in the fields I work with, you know, in counterterrorism and, of course, geopolitics, mostly in the Middle East, but also in other areas, he seems to have the knowledge and to understand what kind of expertise we're bringing him. Because the ideas, for example, of the Abraham Accords, they were there during that meeting. I discussed them with him, the Arab coalition, the vetting process, the jihadi ideology, all of that. He had been prepared already from the end of 2015.
I'm fascinated by Donald Trump. To me, he is something of a phenomenon. The more he's pushed down, the more he seems to gain popularity. And perhaps for another time, we can talk about his election chances. But let me ask you something. If he were to be reelected as the American president, and he gave you a phone call and said, "You're very good at what you do. Please come back and work for me," would you say yes?
Look, when the issue is about national obligation, national interest, and in my own field, you know, my expertise is national security and what we see around the world at this point in time in the Middle East, and even here in America, looking at our southern borders, looking at what the radical jihadists have been preparing to cross into the, you know, the national homeland and cause trouble, I would be inclined to accept his offer if I am asked to. Because of moral and political and historical obligation.
I'll come back to that at the very end of our time. Before that, let's kick off with, I suppose, the big picture question, Doctor. And that is, the Middle East is in a very tense and volatile state at the moment. Some use emotive language like it's exploding or melting down with clear nuclear inferences there. What do you think Tehran's intentions are? Was it retaliation for what they would say was an unprovoked assault, an illegal assault in Syria, which killed some of their high command? Or do they have a different intent, in your opinion?
The Iran regime, which I followed, monitored, analyzed for over 30 years, 35 years, they play chess. They play solid chess. They have an ideology. And they have a strategy which they put at the service of the ideology. So probably in a contest between America and Iran, the Iran regime, that is, they are doing the right thing for their own goals because they have a plan. Unfortunately, we changed the plan in America. Under the Obama 8 years, we have certainly withdrawn from the confrontation with the jihadists, with the terrorists. Remember, he signed an agreement with the Iran regime in 2015, which he had prepared from 2009, he had engaged the Muslim Brotherhood of Egypt just 1 year before the so-called Arab Spring. So the policy of the United States had diverted from the previous bipartisan policies, meaning under Clinton, under Bush, and all the way through the Cold War, we had some sense of we knew who were the radicals, we knew who were the extremists, we knew, you know, under the Soviet, you know, Soviet Union, Cold War, we were clear where to go. And even in the 90s, we were clear. But the problem started when a influence that is unusually prevalent in the United States radicals get to the administration, that was the Obama administration, and people who were influenced by the Brotherhood and influenced by the Iran regime, that catastrophically changed the scenery. So Trump came in 2017 and changed it back for 4 years. But when he changed it back, he did a couple things that triggered a major campaign against him. He withdrew from the Iran deal, and he put the Iranian Revolutionary Guard on the terror list. He actually destroyed almost the Iran deal because many in America, many in the West were profiting from it. So he was punished. That's my theory in my book, chapter 7, 8, and 9. He was punished probably by the financial influence of the Iran deal. He was submitted to complete rebellion and attacks from within his own bureaucracy. It never happened in America. And the rest, we know what happened. But one of the reasons was the influence of the Iran regime. So that's why Iran, since the Biden administration came to the White House, have been consolidating everything they've got because they are concerned that there will be another change coming next year. They knew that. So what they tried to do by ordering Hamas to attack Israel on the one hand, by actually attacking Israel a few days ago, is to change the status quo. They want to change the status quo. They want their five militias in the region to become the governments. So they are changing the geopolitics of the whole region. They have been getting billions and billions of dollars from the Obama and now from the Biden administration. And let me just conclude on this point. What do we think they've done with that money? Did they reform economically? Did they help the middle class? Did they, started to go towards the Abraham Accord? Just the opposite. They bought weapons. They bought ballistic missiles, which they are using now. They funded these militias. They did a lot of terrorism. But most importantly, they crushed their own people. So now they know that the American public may change policy, may change actual administration, and therefore change policy. They want to create a lot of de facto situation so that any other administration won't be able to change it. That is what they're trying to do now.
Okay, now hold that thought, because I want to explore that a little bit more. I've had dealings with Iran as well, and I want to play, to some extent, devil's advocate. I'm not suggesting the Iranians are the devils, by the way, here, but I'm really interested in talking with you about this. Don't go anywhere. We're going to have a quick break. And after that, I want to explore a little bit more about why you think that Iranian politics is, to some extent, transactional. You're watching The Mark Marano Show with me, Len Bitopek. I'm just standing in for him for a few days right here in today's News Talk TNT. I'll see you in a moment.
What a news day this is turning out to be.
Let's finish it.
TNT Radio News.
For TNT, this is James O'Neill. Following Iran's missile and drone attack on Israel, Israel's war cabinet has resolved to take clear and decisive action, although any response will adhere to guidelines set by the United States. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has called for the Western nations to extend support to Ukraine in its conflict with Russia, comparable to the assistance provided to Israel during recent Iranian airstrikes. Jury selection has commenced in the criminal trial of former U.S. President Donald Trump.
Why not give TNT Radio a follow? We're on all major social platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Gab, and Getter. Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time right here on today's News Talk.
TNT Radio.
TNT Radio.
Welcome back to The Mark Marano Show, where I, Len Bitopek, I'm just standing in for a few days for my friend and colleague. Don't worry, we are going to cover very much the same kind of subject areas right here on today's News Talk. And with me now is the esteemed Dr. Waleed Faris, who's a true expert about Iranian foreign policy when it comes to the UK, US, no, not the UK, sorry. Sorry, Dr. Faris, it's only where I'm sitting in London that causes me to make that error. I'm going to ask you about the UK foreign policy as well in a minute. And I want to talk a little bit more about your book. I think we probably have a picture of your book as well, which we might be able to show. Tell us about what your book, it's called Iran, and I think it's called, the full name of it is, well, what is the full name of it? You can tell me.
It's Iran Imperialist Republic and U.S. Policy. It's the transfer of politics from the Shah to the Islamic Republic, and also it covers the revolution, the situation of women, minorities, and youth in Iran, and what are the trends within the Iranian society at this point in time, and of course the reformers inside Iran.
You've basically written that essentially as a guide, I suppose, to what the United States in particular should do. Is that right?
Yes. The second part of the title clears it. It says and U.S. policy, because Americans in general, and particularly in government, in Congress and in the administration, they are divided on Iran. They are divided on what to do now, and they're divided on what to do in the future. You have one slice of the American political establishment that wants to pursue the Iran deal, hoping that it would work, hoping that that would change the course of relationship between Iran and the U.S. And then a second segment of politics here, mostly the majority in Congress, I wouldn't say mostly Republicans, but also some Democrats as well. So Americans are divided on Iran, not on party lines, but on lobbies, if you want, or on influence. And what Trump has tried to do was to put enough pressure on the Islamic Republic of Iran to have them change course. That was his bet. The difference with the Biden-Obama, and mostly Obama administration, is, give them the money, but and hope that they would change without any pressure, without even dealing with the youth or with the civil society of Iran. So I tried to make that comparison to try to understand if a Biden administration comes back, I don't know what would happen. And if a Trump administration comes in again, what would be the chances for this relationship between the U.S. and Iran?
That's a complicated calculation. Let's talk about one of the most interesting aspects of your book. Maybe all politics is transactional. I have to say, I do believe that from my own experience in British politics. But you make a particular point saying that the deal is a transaction. Is it more of a transaction between Iran and the rest of the world and the West than usual? You said before that Iran plays chess. I certainly agree with that. And they play chess well, I think. In political terms. Why do you specifically say that why do you go to such a point of emphasis about the transactional nature of Iran's behavior?
In my view, the Iran deal was designed as a transaction. Why? Because I heard it from the Iranians even before those who in Washington have adopted it, actually adopted it. I mean, it was when Senator at the time, Obama, was campaigning in 2006, 2007, and then 2008. Many among his supporters, including in Congress, in the Senate, and of course, NGOs, were talking about the forthcoming deal. They called it already the deal, which is going to change, in their view, the behavior of Iran. So there was a bet between Senator Obama and Senator Kerry at the time, and academics on our campuses and universities, trying to disentangle the United States, which was in Iraq and in Afghanistan, by counting on some sort of partnership, quote unquote, with that Iran regime or Iran government. And at the core of it was this: we have a lot of Iranian money frozen Iranian money, which was frozen since 1979. So let's have a deal with Tehran. We release that money to them and they will change behavior. They will change course. And the course, number one course, was the nuclear power. So we pay you, you don't do nuclear. That was the actual origin. But this was recovered, this whole transaction, which was political essentially. So we pay you your money, that's Iran's money. So we consider them responsible custodian for the money. And in return, you stop the building of a nuclear bomb. What happened is that the second layer that came in to the Obama administration calculated differently, a little bit differently. They said, well, we will send you money, but you're going to send us back money. It's like a broker, meaning all the consultancy that you can imagine, the law firms, the media, the academia, who lobbied for that deal, said, well, we have something to get here. And so the calculation was $150 billion went to Iran. 10% of this is $15 billion, which some would believe, analysts would believe, have been spent in Western Europe, including Britain and also the United States, to further the influence of Iran.
Oh, the way you describe it, though, it doesn't sound very frightening, because just as with China and America, where there's all kinds of saber rattling, but fundamentally America buys $500 trillion of trade a year from China, there's no real prospect of a war there. So also, if we got stitched in at an economically intimate level with Iran, surely that would moderate Iran because they wouldn't want to lose the standard of living. And it would warm the interaction between America and the Iranian people. And let's be under no pretense. You know as well as I do that Iran is a regional superpower.
It is a regional superpower. The question is going to be, it's the same debate that took place then. Are we trusting this Iranian Khomeinist leadership to do exactly that? Because it seems to me, as an academic in the beginning, that many who have designed the Iran deal projected Western values and Western development on an Islamic Republic. That is not exactly what they had in mind. They will continue to maintain a relationship with any administration that would offer them that help. But that doesn't mean that they're going to actually change and become more liberal, take care of the middle class, not crush the opposition, as we saw increasingly over the past 3 months, and most importantly, not fund the militia. So Trump was trying to say this: I'm not against releasing the money to the Iranian government, but they have to stop practicing some of the things that we consider dangerous. And now we see them. We see the Houthis almost intercepting international commerce and waterways. We see what attacks against Israel. We see, more importantly, I mean, over the past 3 years, attacks against Saudi Arabia, UAE, and obviously, as I mentioned earlier, the behavior with regard to the Iranian Spring Revolution. But I would say at the end of the day, I agree with you on the other example was China. Yes, China and us, we are on different ideological spectrum. The only difference, China is not actually expanding militarily in its own region yet. Who knows, with Taiwan. Versus you have 4 or 5 militias in Iraq, in Syria, in Lebanon, Hezbollah, Houthis in Yemen. That is the difference between, you know, resolving it with Iran by having Iran shrink its military presence and resolving it with China. China is interested in that. I think that what you have advanced applies to China. China is communist, but acts like a capitalist system now. They want to make money. They want to grow their, you know, middle class and you know, give them the goodies. That's the difference between China and Iran, in my opinion.
I nearly moved to Guangzhou, but that's a story for another time, with an American capitalist company, but that's for another time. In a moment, I want to really ask you about the issue everyone's scared of talking about, but is the nuclear question. Also really about how we've moved forward from this, and obviously your perspective on the current exchange between Israel and Iran, all of that coming up in a moment. You're watching The Mark Morano Show with me, Len Bitopek, standing in for a few days for Mark here on today's News Talk. I'll see you in a minute.
It's been said that when someone you love has Parkinson's, you have Parkinson's. The truth is, Parkinson's disease doesn't just affect the diagnosed. It affects everyone who supports and helps care for them. Worldwide, over 10 million people are living with Parkinson's, a neurological disease that affects movement. And with so many places to search for information, it can be difficult to know where to begin. The Parkinson's Foundation has answers. Answers for everyone in the fight. We can help you understand the disease, help you find expert care, give you tips for living a better life, share the latest research, help you find local support, and there's a free helpline you can call. Find your answers and join us in the fight against Parkinson's. To learn more, please go to parkinson.org or call 1-800-4PD-INFO. The Parkinson's Foundation. Better lives together.
The impact of a meal goes well beyond feeding our bodies. Because when people are fed, futures are nourished. Everyone deserves to live a full life. And with your help, together we can end hunger. Join the movement at feedingamerica.org/act now.
Fearless, informative, and unfettered, Mark Morano is unleashed on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Mark Morano's Unleashed with me, Len Bitopek, just standing in for a few days, and he'll be back on Friday. We're talking with Dr. Waleed Faris, who is a true expert about Iran and American foreign policy towards Iran. Thanks for being with us once again, Dr. Faris. I want to really ask you this question, which I don't see expressed explicitly in some of the media which is essentially state-sponsored, but I'll put it on the table. People who aren't very political, who I know, are worried about some sort of a nuclear exchange, between Iran and Israel. Now, I want to slightly nuance the question. It seemed to me that Iran was cooperating with the nuclear deal. And then Donald Trump, who you've praised for re-establishing a different relationship, didn't sign it. Why do you think it was a good thing when Iran at least was stating it was trying to get peaceful nuclear power and was willing to be verified?
Precisely the word you've used, stating. So in general, the statement was good. And actually, even as I remember, as one of the advisors of Trump, they tried to come in the first year of the Trump administration and to engage in a dialogue. And if you remember, there were incidents when one time the Iranians shot down a drone. And Donald Trump at the time said, I'm not going to retaliate. So there were a lot of talks between Iran through third parties, obviously, and Trump at the time during his presidency, that we could cut a new deal. And as a matter of fact, and I was a little bit critical of that, but now that you are mentioning this, he said, I don't want this deal, but I want another deal. So he was not for the idea of no deal. He said, yeah, but we need to sit down, negotiate. Probably this was his way of saying, I don't want the Obama deal, not the Iran deal, the Obama deal. I want my deal, the Trump deal. And he loved deals in general. Now, the tenets of his deals would be, yes, he would send money to Iran, but he would want to see a program. And the Iranian leadership didn't want that. This is sovereign money. So they would decide what to do with it. So his intelligence services would, you know, they were divided at the time. Some would tell him the money you are releasing is going to be used on strategic aggrandizement, on you know, mobilizing, on seizing more territories in the, and eventually in clashing with Israel, which you're going to discuss with me in a second, I believe. So the Trump administration is not opposed to deals. They want conditions. They want a change of behavior. And that would have been the case had he been reelected. Now, a new Trump administration, I think, is going to adopt the same position. Because once he is in government, once he is in the administration, then he is going to listen to the people who are informed, the intelligence services and others, and then make a call on this one.
Now, that has so little time, so much to ask you. I'm going to ask you to come back to my show you are willing to have a weekend when we have just a little bit more time to explore this. But let me go to the obvious question here then. Did Trump want to do a different deal for the sake of it being a Trump deal, or did he sincerely not believe in the Obama one?
He actually believed that his deals are the best deals. That's his right. He's a politician. So, and then he saw some defects, there were defective component of the deal, which is the guarantees of results, which is also, there were no negotiations about the militias. He was very, very worried about the militias. There were also the opinion of Israel, the opinion also of Saudi Arabia. So all that kind of played in. Remember, in 2017, you know, in the first few months, he was thinking about, a new deal with Iran, that he will sit bilateral with the Iranians. And then, of course, came May of 2017, where he visited Saudi Arabia, and then he met with those 50 leaders. And the Saudis, you know, did the reception very well. So he started to listen, obviously, to the Arab coalition that was building there. And of course, he was listening very closely to the Israelis. And the consensus, a new consensus was built, which is, first, let's create our own alliance. Let's create our own little NATO in the region. And then all together we go and negotiate with the Iran. So there were two approaches by the Trump administration. One bilateral, he didn't have time for it, because of also domestic matters that started to become very difficult. Remember the Russian affair and all what came around it consumed a lot of his energies. So I don't think it's only about this is Obama's and this is mine. He really wanted to do negotiations. Actually, his entire approach to politics is one that is transactional himself, even more than Obama.
Donald Trump, in my view, achieved a unique relationship with Kim Jong-un of North Korea. And although he called him the little rocket man, it seemed to me that there was a certain strange affection between the two of them. I felt safer when Trump was in the White House because they were talking. I wonder if it's, maybe I'm just being a naive optimist here, but if Trump were to win, would he do a better job than Biden? Now, you've inferred, I'll ask you a specific question. You've inferred that Biden's policies are not really in line with what you'd want. What's wrong with Biden's policies explicitly that Trump would put right? A different deal or a different approach?
I think at this point in time, his analysis, that's Trump, former President Trump, maybe future President Trump, is that Biden was always late to address the issues. For example, he was late to address the Ukraine-Russia matter. This is a matter that Trump would have started working on immediately. He would have cut deal between Russia and Ukraine, stopped the war. This is a gigantic, very risky war, and that has been absorbing tens of billions of dollars from us. And the result is going to be the same. The result is going to be a negotiated solution. There is no military solution in Ukraine. I mean, otherwise, we're going to spend another 50 years and $1 trillion going nowhere. Neither Russia was able to take the capital of Ukraine. Neither Ukraine is going to be able to defeat Russia and push it back to the international borders. They have to sit down and talk. So that would be one thing I believe a President Trump will start with immediately. Second, he will definitely look at the Middle East and then sit down with all the leaders and tell them we want peace. So he's going to support the Abraham Accord, but he's going to say we need other accords with other countries. This is why I see an angle of possibility that Trump, a future Trump administration, will renegotiate everything regarding Iran.
Now, if that happens, would the world be safer? As you well know, lots of people say that Trump is some unstable, unpredictable person who can't be trusted because he's not part of the establishment. I put that last bit in myself, but that's what they imply. Would he stabilize the world? Would he be able to reach out to Tehran, bearing in mind that General Soleimani, an incredibly popular leader, character and potentially a premier of Iran, was assassinated under Trump's leadership?
Yes, but even that period, which I looked at very closely, is now behind. I mean, what we see on the ground, and I'm eager to share my modest opinion on the exchange, the nuclear exchange that you just mentioned. But let me say one thing, is that Israel and Iran are locked into a confrontation. So what I believe a new Trump administration will do is to stop it, stop any possibility of nuclear exchange. That's the ultimate goal, because in Ukraine doesn't have nukes. Russia have nukes, but they know if they use them, they will get hit as well. I mean, if they use them in Ukraine. Remember Chernobyl, how that, affected a lot of things. So even people, try to accuse Russia of willing to use nukes. They know. I mean, we are in a world where if you start with the first strike, you're going to get the second strike. Same probably in the Middle East. You want to make sure that neither Israel nor the Iranian government regime will use nukes or anything that resembles to nukes, because people don't know exactly what Iran has. People think that all the production is going to be this uranium enrichment up and down. Maybe Iran has already tactical nukes with all the money they had. Who knows? Maybe they will surprise us like Pakistan and India. If you recall, in 1999, they detonated their, their nuclear bombs and said, we are part of the nuclear club. Now you deal with us in a different way. I still believe this is a scenario that can happen, that the Iran leadership will say, wait a minute, if you want to go at war with me, I have a nuclear power. So they will force a different approach to negotiation. So a lot of question marks about it.
Before we've organically gone into the subject I wanted to ask you about, just a few comments coming in on tntradio.live. I don't tend to censor these things, and I don't have time to argue too much with the people who put these in. Holly says, my dog could do a better job. It's all a big game, and we are just the audience. And Russia doesn't want the Ukraine, for goodness sake. But America does. That's what Holly says. Another brick in the wall says, donor 29. Johnny Dollar says, not that I advocate assassinations, but he was no hero about Soleimani. El Cid just doesn't really agree with your assessment. just doesn't have the same view as you. But as I say, I'm not expecting you to defend yourself against all those things. I'm just reading them out so that the dialogue can continue on tntradio.live as well in the chat. Just down to this point then, Israel launched the attack on the consulate in Syria, killing high command members of Iran. Iran gave notice that it was going to respond. Some say Iran did it on purpose to look tough without causing major casualties. Israel's now said we're going to respond, but hasn't yet, with the Americans clearly saying we will have no part in an attack in Iran. Can you decipher the true intentions of Israel, Iran, and America in this situation? And did we end up here by accident or design?
It's funny because my article in the Independent Arabia version this morning is about that. So let me just summarize from the point, the questions you've asked, fascinating questions. Number one, the incident or the clash or what happened in Damascus, meaning the strikes by the Israelis against the Pasdaran leaders, one would say, were not an isolated case. Israel and Iran have been in low-intensity conflict for the previous 1 or 2 years, since 2022. And of course, they had been having incidents. Israel was trying to cut off the Iranian military machine from that highway they're building through Iraq into Syria, into Lebanon with Hezbollah, or the Eastern Mediterranean. Why? Because Eastern Mediterranean has these large pockets of gas. That's the problem, really, has to do with energy. So the Iranians were installing all these forces and then their offices, including in Damascus. Damascus seemed to have been the center. And of course, the Israelis have accused Iran of funding and supporting Hezbollah and the other militias. So they did their strike to send a message to the Iranians that you can't approach Israel that much. Definitely the Iranians are not going to accept to be hit and not respond. So they prepared their response, and they did what they did with Israel. But it seems to me, as I'm reading this, that both sides are not going full-fledged against each other at this point. Mm. Iran can do much more. I mean, yes, they sent hundreds of, but not the real big missiles that they have. And the Israelis, in my view, if they don't have the support of the administration, of this administration, they may strike inside Iran, but without a U.S. support in the region, this may not end up as being a defeat to Iran. So they are now playing this attrition war until the United States decide what it is going to do before the elections.
Who wins in this situation? America, Iran, Israel, or other? Please specify.
Iran for now. If Iran is not hit and crumbling, it is the winner because it's been supplied. If you look at the back of Iran, you have Russia and China. So that, and that they have nothing to lose in this the situation. Israel would lose now because its economy, because the hits against its centers, people will be afraid to travel to Israel. And the United States is already, in my view, that's my humble view, in a foreign policy chaos at this point in time. Decisions are not being made. We don't know what to do with Ukraine. We don't know what to do with the migration issue in the Mediterranean and here. So Iran for now. But if there is a change of policy and or if Iran doesn't respect the red line, basically, meaning going on force against the Israelis will use that to say, I'm going against Iran without the United States. So it depends on what the leadership of Iran wants to do. If they say, okay, we won now, we should not go beyond it. Otherwise, we are giving the card to Israel and Israel can hit us really deeper without the intervention of the U.S. That would be a change of balance in the region. Because Israel can damage a lot of things in Iran and can do one thing other than that, which is to start funding, training Iranian opposition movements. That is something the regime doesn't want to see happen.
In a game of poker, a gambling game of cards, people get dealt different hands, and it's often down to the quality of how well you play your hand that matters, so you can win with a weaker hand. It sounds to me that perhaps Iran's playing its hand, a weaker hand, better than the others.
For now, I agree with this, and I actually spoke to many members of Congress, made briefings, said, for now, until now, Western policies have not been as strategic as Iranian policy with their allies, of course, and look at the results of what's happening in with the Houthis, what's happening. I mean, they threatened Hezbollah, but nothing happened. If you don't change the equation on the ground and you keep doing drones and strikes from the air, you know, you cannot win wars from the air. And the region now does not allow changes on the ground at this point in time, the status quo as it exists. So Iran wins, but will risk big if they want to change the status quo with their achievement at this point in time.
Dr. Walid Faris, you have to come back to my show. I've got so much more to talk with you. A real pleasure to have you on today's News Talk TNT. I hope you found it useful too. We'll have you back again in the near future. That was Dr. Walid Faris. And continuing after the break, we're going to be talking to somebody else who knows a great deal about this, Dr. John Holtzman, the author of The Last Best Hope, A History of American Realism. And that follows naturally from what we've been discussing. Lots of comments coming in. I'll read them after the break as well. I didn't want to take the time away from Dr. Faris. You're watching The Mark Morana Show, Unleashed, with me, Len Bitopic, just for a few days. I'll see you after the break.